Talk Show.
Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities." Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, "Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation." Today is December 27th, Sunday 2009, and Bill Fink is joining us for Russia Number 1, a collection of reports on Bolshevism in Russia. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, Sword Brethren. How are you? Praise Yahweh.
Quite well. Yes, praise Yahweh. And you started to read over this document, but you said you wanted to, before we get into the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, you wanted to cover the background of how Russia was a solidly decent nation, contrary to the mainstream view that it was some backwater, second-rate, agrarian society of basically oppressed serfs.
Oh, right. Russia was an incredibly free nation. And I'd like to make a presentation of a few pages from The Third Rome by Matthew Raphael Johnson. And this is an excellent book, and I read it 6 or 7 years ago, I guess. And he is a Russophile, don't get me wrong. He very much loves the Eastern Orthodox Church and its traditions. And he is definitely a lover of Tsarist Russia. And he makes a balanced presentation. I mean, he points out its faults, but he's he's a Slavophile, but he's also a revisionist historian who instead of getting his history from the emotions of the day, which is how most American historians get their history, he gets it from documentary evidence and actually examines the facts before he publishes them.
Would you agree that it seems the prevailing view and with American historians is that the Tsar was aloof, incompetent, or if not outright tyrannical, and that he had to be removed, the Bolsheviks came in and took care of him, and things might have gotten a bit out of hand, but it was
for
the
best. Well, all of these mainstream historians, not every single one of them, but they operated the whims of their editor, their book editors and their book publishers, and they want to be published, and they like their seats in academia, and that they go along with the mainstream flow and what their Wall Street banker masters want them to print. That's the way it is. That's evident. That's so blatantly evident in some history books. It's incredible.
They're beholden to the Jew.
Right. And I have this. I have a world history book that I used on my presentation last week of the Crusades with Clifton Emmerheiser, and I know from many other sources that the First Crusade, just when the First Crusade was launched, the Crusaders did a pogrom against the Jews of Frankfurt, Germany, and actually exterminated a lot of Jews and ran a lot of them off. And I have this World Encyclopedia of World History, which is supposed to be a very distinguished book of world history, that makes not one mention of it. Maybe 100 pages on a medieval period around that time, or 200 pages, and no mention of the pogroms against the Jews in Europe in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries. That's incredible. Not one mention.
Now, why would they omit that? What would they gain by omitting that?
Well, they should admit it because it was part of history. They've left it out.
No, I mean, by omitting it, what do they gain?
What do they gain? They gain this. People don't ask questions about why the Jews were being run off.
That would be the main question people would ask. Why were these things happening? And the Jews, of course, would have to say, for no reason.
Well, of course. But, I mean, people might see the pattern. People might wake up. And that's just, it's in other books, but in this one supposedly distinguished general overview of world civilization, where many tiny, incredible little details are mentioned, the pogroms against the Jews in the Middle Ages are left out. It's incredible. And that's just one example. But, okay, to get on with Russia, and Tsarist Russia has been extremely, it's misportrayed. It's just a straight lie. What Americans write about Tsarist Russia is an incredible lie, and they write it for one reason. They write it to alleviate and cover for the crimes of the Bolsheviks, who were all Jewish. And Tsarist Russia was incredibly Christian. It, if not in actual Christian practice, at least in the circumstance and the ritual and the trappings of the Orthodox Church. Okay, Nicholas II was brought to the throne. This is from page 200 of The Third Rome by Michael Raphael Johnson. Nicholas II was brought to the throne in 1894. He found a Russia far from being backward, but in a few years, by the start of World War I, was the envy of the world. She had the lowest taxes in all Europe. Direct taxation, and he gives figures in rubles. Direct taxation per capita amounted to 3.1 rubles per year versus 13 for Germany, 10 for Austria, 12 in France, and 27 in progressive, democratic, and capitalist Britain. Indirect taxation was also the lowest in Europe, amounting to 6 rubles per capita for Russia, but 10 for Germany, 11 for Austria, 16 for France, and 14 for Britain. And Johnson gives his sources. Primary education was open to all classes and was free of charge. At the turn of the century, there were 10,000 primary schools opening in the empire per year. Yes, per year. By 1913, over 500 million rubles per year were being invested in education, comparatively more per capita than any other nation in Europe. University study in Russia was the least expensive anywhere in Europe or America, $75 per year, compared with over $1,000 per semester in England and in America. To relieve overpopulation, Tsar Nicholas II eliminated all taxes and provided farm implements to those peasants who would move into less populated and more recently absorbed regions of the empire. By 1917, the peasantry controlled the overwhelming majority of farmland, more than three times what was controlled by the nobility. Such a record was matchless in Europe at the time and still remains unmatched as the big conglomerates, in full union with the American Department of Agriculture, destroy the family farm and set up the new serfdom under Archer Daniels, Midland, and ConAgra. He's comparing it to modern America.
All right.
Under the reactionary, and he says reactionary in quotes because that's what the mainstream historians consider it. Under the reactionary regime of Alexander III, the state peasant bank was chartered, which transferred almost all of the remainder of the land to the peasantry. This bank, which provided cheap credit to the farming classes, became the largest credit union on earth, entirely dedicated to the purpose of the peasantry buying land for themselves. One more sentence to this paragraph. After a few years, Russian peasants owned 80% of the land. Later, beginning in 1905, the People's Bank of Mutual Credit was opened and even provided free lectures to peasants on how to use the system. Go on.
Well, I'd like to point out here that if Alexander III was reactionary in any regard, it was probably because his father, Alexander II, despite being a reformer, was blown to pieces by suicide bombers, part of an organization known as Narodnaya Volya, in English, that would be the people's will. They were basically a bunch of Jews.
Who does that mean?
a bunch of Jews. They wanted, quote, universal suffrage, permanent people's representation, freedom of speech, press, assembly, communal self-government. They wanted the permanent army gotten rid of and replaced with a people's volunteer corps. And they wanted transfer of all land to the people and the placement of factories under control of the workers. And as land transfers began under Alexander II, they shifted their demand from transfer of land to the peasants to the abolition of all private property, since that was no longer a wedge issue, since the peasants were getting the land they needed.
And yeah, they just want to destroy things for the sake of taking them over.
And then eventually they called for an abolition of the church and free love communes.
Well, does your article, does it cite any of the names behind this organization?
Alexander Kratovsky, Sofia Peroxia, Vera Figner, Nikolai Morozov, Lev Tikhomarev.
That's a Jewish name.
Absolutely. These people are basically all Jews. And it points out that they all came from very elite backgrounds.
In terms of agricultural production, the program of land redistribution was immensely successful. By 1913, 12% of the Russian harvest was exported. She accounted for 67% of the world's production of rye, 31% of wheat, 30% of oats, and almost half the globe's production of barley. Given that the peasants controlled the land, they benefited the most, and their income was markedly increased during this period. The Russian fishing industry was the largest in the world, as was her sugar industry. Fully processed iron production increased over 100% from 1898 to 1913. Production of copper increased almost 150% at the same time. The output of gold increased 300%, manganese 100%, and coal 900% in this same time period. The Russian trade surplus by 1913 was 365 million rubles, up from a mere 163 million in 1903. The national debt amounted to 59 rubles per person in 1910. Compare that with 135 in Germany, 170 in Britain, 190 in Italy, and almost 300 in France. Industry, additionally, was growing at the rate of 8% a year, higher even than in the United States. All of this was done under the, and he's stabbing the mainstream, his stabbing at the mainstream historians again. All of this was done under the incompetent reign of the naive and weak Nicholas II and the tyrannical Alexander III, and with a Russian population that was, according to nearly all the mainstream work on Russian history to date, backward, illiterate, lazy, stupid, and superstitious. And this is how the mainstream media portrays to this day Tsarist Russia to the people of the West. And the truth is exactly the opposite. There is little question that in spite of the English language history, Imperial Russia during this time was likely the best run state in Europe, one without the benefit of, and he says that sarcastically, of Republican politics or capitalist economics. What is even more telling is that Russia was just beginning her economic expansion into world markets. There can be no question that the refusal of the Romanovs to set up a central bank under the rule of the global financial elite marked them for extinction. Imperial Russia was the only major European power that refused to set up a central bank, and I thought Kaiser Wilhelm did too, but that's besides the point, though the Bolsheviks, as always, willingly obliged. And that shows that the bottom line is that the Rothschilds were afraid of Russia and had to control it. That they saw Russia as it, and Johnson will get into this a little later. He gets into this a little later. I don't know how I'll get into it. But they were afraid of Russia, Russia as an international power competing with England and their control of the world, so they had to destroy it.
So it boils down to whatever nation will not acquiesce to their demands and hand over control of all of their finances to the Jew is going to be marked for destruction.
Exactly. I'm going to to skip ahead a little. No, I'm not. I can't. On the cultural and political level, the contemporary literature on Russian history tells us that Imperial Russia imposed a reign of terror on a population in censorship and police surveillance. They need to answer how the massive and often liberal literary production in the 19th century Russia is compatible with this. This was the age of Chekhov, Turgenev, Gorky, Balmont, and Gumilev. That is, why is it that Lenin's newspaper, Pravda, was freely published and distributed in St. Petersburg under Nicholas II and his tyranny? And he puts tyranny in quotes. Not only Pravda, but 12 daily newspapers were published by agents of the St. Petersburg Soviet. Rather, scholars like Yale's George Vernadsky simply claim Nicholas II's domestic policy consisted in continuing by inertia the policy of his father. The internal policy of Alexander III had been, first of all, to strengthen government control in all directions where public opinion might be expected to manifest itself. And then he says, scholars like Dukes and Carmichael simply nod their heads, in other words, to Vernadsky's statements.
So, what mainstream historians say about that? If Russia was so oppressive, how was Lenin freely publishing a newspaper?
Well,
they never addressed that issue.
And that's exactly the point Johnson's making. How were all these Jewish Soviets publishing these newspapers freely in St. Petersburg if Russia was so, you know, and all these other great artists or you know, philosophers and writers, how could they exist so freely and have their works published if Russia was oppressive? And Johnson is pointing out that hypocrisy. He says, simultaneously, Reginald E. Zelnick, another writer, writes, without doubt, the reign of Nicholas II witnessed extraordinary artistic creativity, so much so that cultural historians routinely use terms as Silver Age, Second Golden Age, and Cultural Renaissance. Of course, these two sentiments, meaning Zelnick's sentiment, contrary to the other historians' sentiments, are mutually exclusive. Now Johnson goes right into his discussion of revolutionary groups at this time. The overwhelming majority of the funds for the revolutionary groups as the 19th century turned into the 20th century in Tsarist Russia came from, as always, the elite, both in and out of the country. Revolutions, in spite of establishment political scientists, are always from the top down. What is amazing is how mainstream history refuses to deal with these questions. For the 1905 uprising, the majority of the funds from the Social Democratic Party came from the famed author Maxim Gorky. And we have that Gorky Park, and that's famous, and he's actually a celebrated figure. To continue, his mistress, the actress Adraeva, and millionaire industrialist Sava Morozov. Morozov listed the communists as the beneficiaries of his will. He committed suicide conveniently in 1905. Outside of the major American and British banking families that financed the revolution of 1917, another important source of funding came from a Ukrainian sugar tycoon named Tereshenko. Unfortunately, and we have to remember that Germany was at war with Tsarist Russia at the time. Unfortunately, also, the German government, at war with Russia in 1914, gave Lenin's movement 70 million marks. Generals Hoffmann and Ludendorff admitted as much when the latter wrote, Germany dispatched Lenin to Russia. This step was justified from the military point of view, as it was imperative that Russia should fall. So we helped ourselves do this, right? That's the way it always works. Lenin also admitted German assistance, claiming to the Central Committee under Sverdlov, I am frequently accused of having won our revolution with the aid of German money. I have never denied the fact, nor do I do so now. I will add, though, that with Russian money, we shall stage a similar revolution in Germany. Furthermore, as the revolution broke out in 1917, the radical railway workers kept food and fresh troops from the capital. The police force was small, and the troops were not troops at all, but middle-aged peasants called up to fill in for soldiers at the front. They had no training and were angry that they were called away from home, as most of them were the only breadwinners for their families. Thus, the entire revolutionary movement had to be fought with a handful of policemen carrying revolvers. The number of law enforcement personnel is controversial. Degulovich claims there were 3,500 members of the St. Petersburg police force. However, Koshan and Keep claim that there were 5,000 full-time policemen in the entire empire of 180 million souls, which would make Russia one very poor example of a police state. In fact, the total number of government workers, including Zemstvo employees, whatever that means, the Zemstvo employees, policemen, and employees at all levels, never exceeded 330,000. By contrast, much smaller France in 1906 had budgeted for 500,000 employees. So we see that, it must be mentioned that foreign influence was always paramount in Russian domestic and foreign policy. It has already been mentioned that the revolution of 1917 was heavily subsidized by Western bankers, but it is less well known that the tribesmen of the Caucasus were equipped by the British, and the Schiff family was giving massive loans to Japan as the Russo-Japanese War broke out. Such massive infusion of cash is what permitted the Japanese to ultimately triumph.
Well, they built up Japan starting in the closing decades of the 19th century. I think they were positioning Japan to be used against Russia, to weaken Russia and demoralize the Russian people.
Well, absolutely, and they did take much great advantage. And Johnson goes into the Russo-Japanese War in about six pages, so it's not brief, and I really don't want to read the whole thing here. But he basically explains how the military in the East did not have time to complete the building of forts, and the biggest problem was getting supplies that far east quickly enough. And because they didn't have time to complete their forts, their defenses were not effective. However, the Japanese, and let me read this, it is well known that the war ended through the mediation of President Theodore Roosevelt, and the Japanese had fully admitted, in spite of all their strategic advantages, that they were exhausted, although the Russian outlay of resources for the fight did not nearly approach that of Japan. In other words, the Japanese, for the gains that they did get, were those gains came at great cost.
So basically, they gave everything in round one, and they were just lucky that there was no round two.
Well, exactly, because Russia had just started moving that far east, and developing that far east. And there was a Trans-Siberia railroad, and the English hated this. Russia was penetrating ever further east, and the Trans-Siberian Railway was the ultimate symbol of that penetration. Siberia was becoming a booming agricultural state, as well as engaging in its more traditional trades of hunting and trapping. Now, shortly after the completion of that, the Russians had a new railroad planned in partnership with China, called the New China Railway, that gave Russia an interest in Manchuria, which at that time was nominally a part of China. So Russia was pushing east and branching out, and the English just hated that.
That would have cut into their Eastern Trade Empire.
Right. And few realized the extent of that war. The front was hundreds of miles long and involved hundreds of thousands of soldiers. True to form, Ryazanovsky and his colleagues are quick to insist that the loss of the war is proof of Russian weakness and the backwardness of her system. The facts, however, are that Russians were extremely overextended in that part of the world. There was one railway that linked the capital to the Far East, and that was not yet complete. In 1905, the fleet under Admiral, I can't pronounce, these Russian names are crazy, Radzhensky, needed to come from the Baltic region to reinforce the still uncompleted forts. By the time they arrived, they were already exhausted. And he goes on to explain how the Jews in Russia took advantage of the war, the loss of the war, to denigrate Russian culture and society, and they did the same thing in the 1960s here during Vietnam.
Despite the fact that they usually instigate the wars.
Right. The bottom line is that the revolution of 1905 was a direct result of the war, as the liberal press went wild attempting to link the loss of to Japan with the backwardness of the system. Such propaganda was heard loud and clear in the Western capitals. The Russian government had long been considered the most threatening competitor to the British Empire. As a result, the financial interests surrounding the House of Rothschild had slated Russia for destruction. Jacob Schiff, long a student of the Rothschild mind and a beneficiary of its largesse, loudly demanded Russia's defeat. This question desperately needs to be dealt with, not least for the reason that the entirety, without exception, of Russia historians refuse to deal with it, so tightly bound are they to the robber baron foundations and their endless fronts for grant disbursements. Why exactly did the greatest capitalists in the world support, finance, and wage a relentless propaganda campaign in favor of the communist revolutionaries? He quotes from Eustace Mullins in the following paragraph, which and Eustace Mullins more or less proves from Lenin's own writings that communism was basically, you know, even though it was a consolidation of the banks into one state banks, it concentrated control into the hands of the people that controlled the banks. And Lenin explains that. And Johnson sums it up. Lenin writes that, and Johnson quotes it from Eustace Mullins, and then he sums it up this way. In other words, the communist program has always been in the interest of the bankers, so long as the communists can be kept under control. To completely standardize the Russian system, which did not have a central bank, was important if the massive wealth of the country was to be controlled. That's all the Jews want. The banker Jews wanted control of Russia and control of Russia's wealth, and to eliminate that as a threat to their hold on British wealth. And it all boils down to the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and the Schiffs and the Warburgs destroying Christendom in Russia, letting the communist Bolshevik rapists have their way so that they could gain control of the nation's wealth.
And essentially, it's two sides of the same coin, isn't it? International communism and international capitalism, since they're both financed by the same cadre of international bankers based out of Manhattan. And if you live in a society that's capitalist and oppressive, will you go running into the waiting arms of the communists who offer you salvation? So no matter who wins, the Jew wins.
Absolutely. Although Jacob Schiff's personal agent, George Kennan, had regularly toured Russia during the later part of the 19th century, bringing in money and arms for the communist revolutionaries, and Schiff's own grandson had said that Schiff spent $20 million to bring about the Bolshevik Revolution, more concerted aid was called for to support an entire regime. Kennan also aided Schiff in financing the Japanese in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905. The Japanese decorated Kennan with the Gold War Medal and the Order of Sacred Treasure. So the Japanese are decorating a banker with war medals. That's pretty obvious. In 1915, the American International Corporation was formed in New York. Its principal goal was the coordination of aid, particularly financial assistance to the Bolsheviks, which had previously been provided by Schiff and other bankers on an informal basis. The new firm was funded by J.P. Morgan, the Rockefellers, and the National City Bank.
Well, did you mention that Jacob Schiff also was a recipient of the Order of Sacred Treasure?
Okay, he doesn't mention that here.
He was a second-class gold and silver star.
The connections between the Schiff, Rockefeller, and Rothschild interests and the Bolsheviks, all Russian revolutionaries of whatever stripe, are generally suppressed by mainstream academia. It is no surprise that the successors of these same capitalists, such as the Rockefeller Foundation cult or the Carnegie Institute, fund the majority of research that takes place in America's hallowed halls. Famous British historian Nesta Webster writes in her Surrender of an Empire, had the Bolsheviks been, as they are frequently represented, a mere gang of revolutionaries out to destroy property, first in Russia and then in every other country, they would naturally have found themselves up against organized resistance by the owners of that property all over the world. And the Moscow blaze would have been rapidly extinguished. It was only owing to the powerful influences behind them that this minority party was able to seize the reins of power, and having seized them, to retain their hold of them to the present day. Now this is good. And further, Anthony Sutton, fellow at the Hoover Institution, writes in his Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. In brief, this is a story of the Bolshevik Revolution and its aftermath, but a story that departs from the usual conceptual straitjacket approach of capitalists versus communists. Our story postulates a partnership between international monopoly capitalism and international revolutionary socialism for their mutual benefit. The final human cost of this alliance has fallen upon the soldiers of the individual, upon the shoulders of the individual Russian and the individual American. Entrepreneurship has been brought into disrepute, and the world has been propelled towards inefficient socialist planning as a result of these monopoly maneuverings in the world of politics and revolution. And he doesn't, yeah, you know, Johnson does a lot to identify these people, but he doesn't go into the fact that all of the top bankers as well as all of the top socialists are all Jews. Johnson really doesn't portray this in this section as a struggle of the Jews against Christendom, which is the way I would portray it. I would say
there were probably enough genuine Russians in that revolution to fill a phone booth.
Well, absolutely, and that's absolutely true, and we'll see that.
And in the white paper, as we get into it, we will see that very few of the officers were actually Russians, and if they were, they weren't there voluntarily. They were held at gunpoint by Chinese henchmen. We will get into that later, though. So by no measure could it be called a Russian Revolution.
Absolutely not, but the point I wanted to make was, the two points I wanted to make in drawing from Johnson was that the Western bankers were fully behind the Bolshevik Revolution, that's one, and two was that Russia was by no means a backwards tyranny, as we are led to believe. It was a vibrant, growing, white, Christian nation. That there is no doubt. And it was, in many ways, even though it was a monarchy, in many ways it was ahead of the rest of the West.
That's probably why it was targeted before any other country.
Well, it was targeted before any other country because the Tsar stood in the way of the Rothschilds. The Tsar would not cave in to the Jewish-controlled central bank that ends up sucking the lifeblood out of every country it gets its claws into. That's exactly what it does.
Because of this, when all these allied nations deployed troops supposedly to help combat the Bolsheviks, you know, the British were there, the Americans were there. Do you think they were actually helping combat the Bolsheviks?
No, absolutely not.
It's hard to imagine how the entire world could fail to stop the Bolsheviks in 1918 and 1919 with the Western Expeditionary Forces that landed all across Russia.
We'll see that shortly with the Russian number one report, won't we?
Yes.
that it's just incredible that the entire world did not see to stop the Bolsheviks, but for one reason, because the bankers did not want to stop the Bolsheviks. And they're the ones, even that early in our history, who were fully in control of the government and what the government would do. Well, I mean, they were in control of England as early as the 1700s. But they were in, you know, in 1913, we handed the American economy over to the bankers. And what did we get out of that? World War I, the Bolshevik Revolution, and the Great Depression. That's exactly what we got out of it. And World War II, and every element that has hounded us since.
All right. I'd like to go ahead and start, before we do the foreword from Russia number one, and read from The Rulers of Russia by Reverend Dennis Fahey from 1938. He briefly discusses Russia number one, and he points out some interesting facts. Is that all right now if I start with this?
Sure.
He says, the foreword of the white paper, that's Russia number one, stated that it was issued in accordance with a decision of the English War Cabinet in January 1919. Subsequent history of this white paper is extraordinary. It speedily disappeared from circulation and became unattainable. Then an abridged edition was issued with the same title at a slightly decreased cost. From the abridged edition, the passage we have quoted, referring to Jews, and some more, had been eliminated. It has never been possible to ascertain how the original document was suppressed. The second document, treating of the financing of the Russian Revolution by the Jewish Bank of Kuhn, Loeb & Company, is the one drawn up by the American Secret Service and transmitted by the French High Commissioner to his government. This document is quoted at length on page 88 to 91 of The Mystical Body of Christ in the Modern World. It was published by the Documentation Catholique of Paris on 6 March 1920 and was preceded by the following remarks. The authenticity of this document is guaranteed to us. With regard to the exactness of the information it contains, the American Secret Service must assume responsibility. This document was quoted in 1920 in a supplement to the paper La Vie Française, which added, all the governments of the Entente were aware of this memorandum drawn from the data of the American Secret Service and sent at the time to the French High Commissioner and his colleagues. In addition to the information about the Jewish banking houses which financed the Russian Revolution, the document also gives the long list of Jews who took over the direction of the Russian people in 1917. Lenin is given as Russian, but all the other 24 given on the list, Trotsky, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Parvus, etc., are stated to be Jews for certain. Would you like me to read some assumed names and some real names?
Yeah, sure, because a lot of people, we have to record that, right?
All right. Assumed name, Lenin. Real name, Ulanov. Assumed name, Trotsky. Real name, Bronstein. Assumed name, Steklov. Real name, Nakanes. Assumed name, Martov. Real name, Zetterbaum.
Sounds like it sounds almost like a list of Hollywood actors. I'm sorry, go on.
Assumed name, Martov. Real name, Zetterbaum. Assumed name, Zinoviev. Real name, Apfelbaum. Assumed name, Kamenev. Real name, Rosenfeld. Assumed name, Dan. Real name, Gurchevich or Yurwitz. Assumed name, Gotenetsky. Real name, Furstenberg. Assumed name, Parvus. Real name, Helpfond. Assumed name, Yuritsky. Real name, Padomusky. Assumed name, Lauren. Real name, Lurgay. Assumed name, Borin. Real name, Nathanson. Assumed name, Martinov. Real name, Zyber. Assumed name, Bogendoff. Real name, Zilberstein. Assumed name, Garin. Real name, Garfeld. Assumed name, Sukhanov. Real name, Gimmel. Assumed name, Kamlinev. Real name, Goldman. Assumed name, Sagarsky. Real name, Krochman. Assumed name, Ryzanov. Real name, Goldenbach. Assumed name, Solotezev. Real name, Bleichman. Assumed name, Pianetsky. Real name, Zuin. Assumed name, Axelrod. Real name, Orthodox. That's cute. Assumed name, Glasnuov. Real name, Schultz. Assumed name, Zereisen. Real name, Weinstein. Assumed name, Lipinski. Real name, Lowenson. And that's the end of the list of the names of the top leaders. Go on.
Yeah, right. I'm sorry. Fahey basically identifies them all. He tells us all. He tells us who they all are. It's incredible. They're all Jews.
And then he goes on, since The Mystical Body of Christ in the Modern World was published, I have had the opportunity of reading that very interesting work entitled All These Things by A.N. Field. In Appendix B, he quotes from Volume 3 of United States Senate Document Number 62, 66th Congress, First Session, some extracts from the evidence of Reverend George A. Simmons, superintendent of the Methodist Episcopal Church in Petrograd from 1907 to October 6, 1918, before a committee of the United States Senate on February 12, 1919. The Reverend Mr. Simmons stated with regard to the Bolshevik government in Petrograd in December 1918, under the presidency of a man known as Apfelbaum, Zinoviev, out of 388 members, only 16 happened to be real Russians, all the rest Jews, with the exception of one man who was a Negro from North America. And 265 of these Jews belonging to this northern commune government that is sitting in the old Smolny Institute come from the Lower East Side of New York, 265 of them. Mr. Field also wrote as follows in the same appendix, Miss Aridina Williams, widow of the late Dr. Harold Williams, for long Manchester Guardian correspondent in Russia, in her book From Liberty to Brest-Litovsk, Macmillan 1919, said, quote, the predominant class which rapidly crystallized around the Bolsheviks was mainly composed of individuals alien to the Russian people, and added, quote, they especially numbered a great many Jews. They spoke Russian badly. The nation over which they had seized power was a stranger to them, and besides, they behaved as invaders in a conquered country. Continuing on, Mr. Field also added in the same place, Lenin was married to a Jewess, spoke Yiddish in his family circle, and Dr. Jaime Weissman, Jewish Zionist leader, was quoted in the London Jewish Chronicle of December 16, 1932, as saying that Lenin had taken part in Jewish student meetings in Switzerland 35 years before. He is generally regarded as Russian, but there is doubt, end quote.
Well, I never believed he was Russian, and there's lots of evidence that, you know, from documentary sources that he was Jewish.
Absolutely.
And Stalin was a Jew, too. Does Fahy go into that?
Not in the pages I have up here right now. He may later on, though. I don't think most people knew that at the time, though, that Stalin was a Jew. But Stalin's name was Yugoshvili, which essentially translates in English to Jewish son or son of a Jew. All three of his marriages were to Jewesses, and all of his children married Jews, and his top advisors were all Jews. So if he wasn't a Jew, he sure fooled me.
Right. I've always heard, and I heard it from Russians, that Stalin's name proves that he's of Jewish extraction.
Yes. And one more thing from this document before we get on to Russia number one. Quote, the movement has never been controlled by Russians. Of the 224 revolutionaries who in 1917 were dispatched to Russia with Lenin to foment the Bolshevik Revolution, 170 were Jews. According to the Times of 29 March 1919, of the 20 or 30 commissaries or leaders who provided the central machinery of the Bolshevist movement, not less than 75% are Jews. Among minor officials, the number is legion. According to official information from Russia, in 1920, out of 545 members of the Bolshevist administration, 447 were Jews. The number of official appointments bestowed upon Jews is entirely out of proportion to their percentage in the state. The population of Soviet Russia is officially given as 158.4 million, the Jewish section, according to the Jewish Encyclopedia, being about 7.8 million. Yet, according to the Jewish Chronicle, January 6, 1933, over one-third of the Jews in Russia have become Communist Party officials, end quote. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Well, it's absolutely amazing that they were able to pull off what they did, and they couldn't have pulled off what they did by themselves, even with all of the New York Wall Street bankers' money. They needed white people on their side. They needed to win some of the goyim, or enough of the goyim to build momentum to their side.
And this document, Russia number one, will prove that they basically failed to do that, so they had to hold people at gunpoint to get them to fight for them. And they absolutely destroyed Russia's economy, so they were able to use hunger as a weapon as well. And I think that they're trying to do that in this country, so it's important we cover what they've done so we can anticipate what they're going to do.
Well, absolutely, because they're definitely, you know, if Christians stand up in this country, that there's definitely going to be to be oppression, and if Christians don't stand up, there's definitely going to be further oppression anyway. They're going to enslave us by force or by
consent.
By consent, yeah, by deception.
So we can either do nothing and get marched off to the gulag, or we can fight and have a chance to avoid the gulag.
Well, absolutely. And where they're now, I mean, they're trying to take the guns and the bullets away from people now, and that's the major obstacle.
And if they can do that
in the Ukraine in the 1920s already.
Absolutely. I imagine if they can do that, we will be in 1918 Russia overnight.
Absolutely. If people stand for it, there's no doubt.
Right. I'm going to read the foreword now. Is that all right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, let's, you know, this Russia number one, let's just say that, well, the foreword will explain it. This is a collection of actual reports from British citizens and others who were actually there and eyewitnessed the Bolshevik Revolution.
Okay. The following collection of reports from His Majesty's official representatives in Russia, from other British subjects who have recently returned from that country, and from independent witnesses of various nationalities, covers the period of the Bolshevik regime from the summer of 1918 to the present date, April 1919. They are issued in accordance with the decision of the War Cabinet in January last. They are unaccompanied by anything in the nature either of comment or introduction, since they speak for themselves in the picture which they present of the principles and methods of Bolshevik rule, the appalling incidents by which it has been accompanied, the economic consequences which have flowed from it, and the almost incalculable misery which it has produced. And just information about the publishing. This was published by His Majesty's Stationery Office, presented to Parliament by command of His Majesty, April 1919. And it's no longer available in any form. If you try and get it from the British Home Office, Foreign Office, they will just give you the runaround, and you have to know exactly what page you want to request if you're going to submit a request for a copy of a page, and then you have to pay for the page.
That's incredible. There's one more quote before we start on Russia number one from Johnson that I'd like to read.
All right.
And he says that there are 50 million deaths perpetrated by communist Russia, and that most of the mainstream historians consider that progressive.
Well, looking at Russia's population growth, had it not been for Bolshevism, there would probably be between 300 and 400 million people in Russia today.
And you know, there's 300 million people here in the United States, right? And we have only a small portion of the land that Russia actually has. And we can be self-sustaining. I mean, we have that capacity. I don't know if we actually are with all the food that we're importing lately.
Well, I think we have the ability, but we don't have the will to be self-sustaining.
Well, that's what I mean. We definitely have the capacity, even with 300 million people, to be self-sustaining. Except that the factory farms are killing us, and they're importing food in the name of globalization.
And the question is, how long will we have the ability to be self-sustaining as our demographics shift to the point where we'll eventually be 50% non-white if we're not already there?
Well, I think we're already 50% non-white. I mean, I don't count all the mud people that the Census Bureau counts as being white.
Absolutely. My numbers, I put a set 58 to 62% white, but I also believe there's about 380 million people in the country, since they're excluding a lot of people, mainly the illegal aliens, the ones that have come here legally and just stayed. They don't count them. I believe there are at least 380 million people in this country, no more than 220 million of whom can be white.
Right, and I think that's a high figure. Because there are a lot of Eastern Europeans. There are a lot that are white, but there are a lot that, well, they claim to be Eastern Europeans and Southern Europeans, and they're definitely not white. They're part Arab or they're part Jew.
Absolutely. All right, a collection of reports on Bolshevism in Russia. Number one, Sir Finley to Mr. Balfour, received August 20, telegraphic.
Now most of these reports are going to Mr. Balfour, and he is a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he's a Jew, and he's in the House of Lords in Britain, in England, and he's evidently the I don't know what his actual title was, but he's evidently in charge of the ambassador corps overseas because they're all reporting to him. These are actually reports to him. These are official reports. These are official reports made by embassy personnel.
I did not know that Balfour was a Jew. I thought he was just a Christian Zionist.
I've always read that he was a Jew. I've read that in a few places. I mean, maybe it can be challenged, but I thought he was a Jew.
Oh, I'm not challenging that. I'm just saying that I'd never heard that before. I wasn't certain.
Okay. All okay, right. I'll remember this week to try to pull a source up for it if I can.
Okay. Christiania dispatched August 19, 1918. I have received following telegram dated the 9th August from Wood's house in Kromai at Petrograd to General Poole. Quote, British subjects have been arrested during the past 2 days without any charge having been made against them, but only two have been detained so far. We protested and asked for explanation. On 5th August, all British officials at Moscow were arrested, but the majority were subsequently released and are presumably now under house arrest. Their probable evacuation was notified to us, and we were warned to be ready to leave with them, but as yet, we have no definite news from them. Commissary threatens to intern all Allied subjects. Please inform London of above, as we are not allowed to telegraph in any direction. Tell London also that up to the present, all are well here. In Petrograd, position of Soviet power is becoming rapidly untenable, and orders are being given for various units and places to be evacuated. That they are in touch with Germans is quite evident. A yacht is ready at Peterhof to take Lenin away. So Lenin was ready to bail.
Well, he was ready to bail from Petrograd. That they were expected, they were expecting great opposition, and their position at this time was still tenuous. You know, it was still shaky. This was the revolution kicked off in October of 1917, but here we're in mid 1918, and they haven't entirely secured their position yet.
So the issue is still undecided.
Yes.
So had all the governments of the world, or even the major powers, intervened, they could have crushed it in its infancy.
Right. Well, we'll see in a couple of reports from now that the Czechs are attempting to intervene.
All right. Number two, Sir Howard to Mr. Balfour, received August 20, dispatch, telegraphic, Stockholm, August 19, 1918. Following is a summary of the more important points in a series of dispatches from Mr. Wardup at Moscow. August 5, about 4:30 this morning, a band of 10 armed men attacked Consulate General and demanded admittance. Without my authority, one of the inmates of the house opened the door, being threatened with firearms. This was the fourth armed raid on the premises. Guards left at 5:30, and local commissary expressed his regret at the incident. During the morning, I learnt of arrest of several British subjects, including Messrs. Armitage, Whitehead, William Cazalet, Hasty, over 70 years old, North, Chaplain, Beringer, Reuters agent, and Miss H. Adams, one of my staff. In the afternoon, while Mr. Lockhart was calling, another raid on the premises was made with warrant for arrest of staff. I protested and declared that I only yielded to force. Office was sealed in great detail, seals being attached to every drawer, to both safes, and to all receptacles for papers, also to outer doors to the office rooms. All the staff were then arrested, including Mr. Stevens, Mr. Douglas, and lady clerks, and conveyed to Soviet's police quarters in Terevskoy Boulevard. Mr. Lockhart, Captain Hicks, and I were not arrested, as Chicherin had promised that consuls and military missions should not be arrested. Their staffs, however, had not been specifically mentioned. French military attaché General Laverne was liberated after short arrest. Staff were detained. Guards were stationed to watch my premises, and I was left in my private apartments there. I do not regard failure to arrest myself and Mr. Lockhart as evidence of intention to treat us better than our staffs, but rather the contrary. I do not regard Bolshevik detention of our nationals as aimed at deterring us from vigorous action in distant places so much as intended to protest Bolshevik leaders on their fall. They are converting houses in center of the city into improvised fortresses in the belief that there will soon be a serious rising in which their allied prisoners will serve as centers. Finally, if they regard all as lost, they will probably hound populace on to massacre these prisoners. August 6, Consul Stevens, Vice Consuls Loudon and Douglas released about 3 a.m., also North and others, and French Consul General Grenard, and French consul Lebrun, by efforts of Swedish colleague who spent the night in negotiations. At 10 p.m., following still detained, vice consuls Wishaw, Greenup, and Jerome, passport officer Webster and his assistant, Ginson, Sr., Tamplin and Linger of Lockhart's staff, Fritz Mukolov, and Mrs. Gobley and Adams of my staff, prisoners so far fairly comfortably housed and fed and allowed to associate with one another, guards conciliatory. I am allowed to go in and out, and Mr. Lockhart and his remaining staff can visit me. August 7, I called at temporary prison and saw Greenup, Wishaw, and Jerome. They are all well treated by their guards, who are real Russians, unlike most of their leaders, who are either fanatics or Jewish adventurers like Trotsky or Radek. All British and French women are now released, also Mr. Beringer and others. I wonder what the women were being held for.
Yeah. Now does it, first, I don't really know what the Bolsheviks had to gain, since they were being financed by British and American bankers, mm-hmm. why they would be arresting these British and American diplomats. Well, we'll find that there was an attempt on Lenin's life. As we read through these, there was an attempt on Lenin's life, and some of the Bolsheviks were blaming it on the British and the French diplomats.
I have a theory. Maybe these particular diplomats were genuine Brits, genuine Americans, and they were Christian patriots who would give sincere reports on what was happening, and they wanted to get rid of them and hope that the positions would be filled with Jews.
Well, that's the only thing that can be ascertained, is that they didn't want reports getting out, or they didn't want these people to see what was happening in the streets, so that they were detaining them or holding them up inside their embassies and their consulates.
August 8, Wishaw, Greenup, Jerome, and Webster brought here this morning by efforts of my Swedish colleague, whole staff at Consulate General now at liberty. It is also suggested that during our stay at Petrograd, we shall be under a Bolshevik guard. Evidently, Bolsheviks are trying to prolong negotiations. City is on the whole quiet. All ex-officers under 60 are to report themselves this morning, probably with a view to their arrest, and there are rumors of wholesale arrest of clergy.
And we'll see that they did arrest, in a few of these reports, we'll see they did arrest all the officers and all the merchants and all of what the Jews consider the bourgeois. And the bourgeois is really the productive middle class. And that's the aim in the Communist Manifesto. That's the goal. The Jews want to destroy the productive middle class.
Absolutely. Number 3, Sir R. Paget to Mr. Balfour, received September 3, urgent, telegraphic, Copenhagen, September 3, 1918, dispatched. Following report from Danish minister at Petrograd has been communicated to me by Danish government. Quote, on August 31st, the government troops forced their way into the British embassy, their entry to which was resisted by British naval attaché Captain Cromie, who, after having killed 3 soldiers, was himself shot. The archives were sacked and everything was destroyed. Captain Cromie's corpse was treated in a horrible manner. Cross of St. George was taken from the body and subsequently worn by one of the murderers. English clergyman was refused permission to repeat prayers over the body. French military mission was forced. A man named Mazan and a soldier and several Frenchmen were arrested. Bolsheviks in the press openly incite to murder British and French. It is urgently necessary that prompt and energetic steps be taken. End quote. And right here, I think we should get into that New York Times article, which you found rather shocking. It's from September 5th, 1918, and it's coming out of the New York Times. The headline reads, Reds at Moscow raid consulate of Great Britain. All England roused over the killing of Captain Cromie at Petrograd. Cabinet stand approved. London press denounces outrage as considered act of the Bolshevist leaders. Czechs captured Chita. London, September 5. The British consulate at Moscow has been attacked according to the Central News today. While the report has not been confirmed, it is felt in diplomatic circles only too likely to be true. An anxiety exists over the fate of R.H. Lockhart, the acting consul general, and J.O. Wardrop, the consul, who have been waiting at Moscow for safe conduct. It appears that the Soviet government insisted that M. Litvinov, Bolshevist ambassador to Great Britain, a Jew, by the way, should be sent to Bergen before it would agree to issue permission for Mr. Lockhart and Mr. Wardrop to depart. So basically they're holding them hostage, aren't they?
Right, and let me explain, take a break from this article for a second. Let me explain why I find this article shocking. Okay? The New York Times has been a leftist Marxist rag for well over 100 years. And this is outright what Johnson's writing about the 30s, but he says in a note on page 215, notice in the left revolutionary press of the United States, such as the New York Times, which lionized Stalin in the 30s through the reporting, and he puts that in quotes, of Walter Duranty, the same tactics are used. Serbs slaughter Muslims for no reason. Palestinians bomb Israeli markets out of blind hate. In other words, he's saying that basically the New York Times is nothing but a propaganda vehicle. And that has been true for quite some time. And for the New York Times, it really shocks me that you found this, that this article, that the New York Times was actually kind of almost upright about what was some of the things that were happening in the Bolshevik Revolution, that they would admit that these Soviet insurrectors are actually storming embassies and arresting all their personnel.
They've granted that the assumption that it happened is true without the proof actually being presented yet, instead of challenging it.
Well, right, and they just, you know, to write anything that's that portrays the Bolsheviks in a negative light is surprising for me to see that in the New York Times at this time. It really is. And the New York Times was actually, it was bought by Adolf Ox in 1896. And he was a Jew, and he was married to the daughter of a rabbi. And that rabbi was the founder of the Hebrew Union College. And he was also one of the leaders of the Reform Jew movement in this country. And he's definitely not your typical rabbi. I mean, he's one of your more rabid rabbis. Yeah, you know, that's how I could explain him. He was notably a practicing Jew, but he just wasn't I don't think he was an outright communist.
All right.
But he bought his newspapers on borrowed money. So what does that tell you? He bought the Chattanooga Times on borrowed money, and a couple of years later, he was actually a Jew in Tennessee, the home of Russell Walker and Troublemaker. And he bought the Chattanooga Times, and then he came to New York. So Jews, that's proof that Jews come to New York from Tennessee, and he bought the New York Times. I'm sorry, go on. I had to throw that in there.
The British government declined to agree to such an arrangement. According to the Evening News, Litvinov, his secretary, and another member of the Bolshevist faction now in London have been taken to Brixton Prison. The attack on the British embassy in Petrograd last Saturday, involving the sacking of the embassy and the killing of Captain Cromie, the British attaché, has aroused intense indignation here. The London Morning newspapers in their editorials denounced the act in the strongest terms and endorsed the British government's action in a demand upon the Bolshevist government for reparations and the threat of outlawry for the members of the Soviet government should it fail to give complete satisfaction or should further acts of violence be committed against British subjects. They assured the government that it will have the support of the nation in enforcing the punishment of the perpetrators. The Times says that the account of the affair given by the Bolshevist newspaper Pravda shows that it was a considered act of the Bolshevist government and not a mere outbreak of brigandage. They're using odd terms back then. I would have said brigandry. It calls for the exemplary punishment of the murderers and their accomplices. It approved the British warning against further acts of violence, adding that there are about 100 British subjects yet in that part of Russia in which the Bolsheviks rule. The Daily Telegraph interprets the meaning of the outrage thus, quote, "The Bolshevist leaders know that their course is nearly run, and having waded in blood to power, they are resolved to shed still more blood before the fatal hour strikes for their own bloody end," end quote. The Chronicle asks how much longer the Russian people will endure the corrupt and bloodstained tyranny which has ruined a once great country and made it a byword of contempt.
100 years? Is 100 years a fair estimate?
According to the Foreign Office's advice, Captain Chromai opposed the Bolshevist troops and killed 3 soldiers with his own hands. Captain Chromai was killed and his corpse was mutilated. The documents at the embassy were destroyed. It is feared that similar outrages will be committed against the French embassy at Petrograd. Precautionary measures have been taken, the Foreign Office says, and some French soldiers already have arrived at Petrograd. The Bolsheviks are reported to be encouraging the populace to massacre the British and French. Captain Francis Chromai, who had received the Distinguished Service Order, was one of the first officers to command a submarine. At the outbreak of the war, he commanded the Hong Kong Submarine Flotilla. In 1913, he commanded the, 1918, he commanded the E-19 in the Baltic, which torpedoed a German destroyer and the German cruiser Undine and sank or captured 10 German steamers. And the rest is just a biography about him. Then it goes on to say that Amsterdam, September 5, details of the search, quote-unquote, of the British embassy in Petrograd last Saturday are given in a dispatch from Moscow, quoting the newspaper Pravda. 40 persons, for the most part British subjects, were arrested, the newspaper states. The reasons for the action were that the Moscow authorities had received a report regarding a connection between various counter-revolutionary organizations and the embassy. One of the Bolshevist commissioners was instructed to investigate the report, it being supposed that the counter-revolutionists Savinkov and Filenko were hiding in the embassy. Accompanied by a detachment of scouts, this commissioner, M. Hiller, went to the embassy and proceeding to the first floor was met by shots, which killed one of the scouts and wounded another. A fight ensued in the corridor, and the scouts were obliged to fire, it is declared, and Attaché Chromai was killed. The police then entered the embassy and arrested 40 persons, including Prince Sakashovsky. It is alleged that weapons and compromising documents were found in the embassy, and that's quoting Pravda, and I don't believe a word of it.
It doesn't wash. Well, when we see that, it won't wash with these reports. They're quoting Pravda, and they were up front at the beginning of the article, but the outcome isn't too good, eh? We'll see that conflicts with these reports as we progress through the reports, the actual reports from the British Embassy.
Pravda is just a smokescreen. It's there to obfuscate the truth.
Well, right. That was Lenin's paper, and it became the, I guess because of Lenin himself, of course, and the connection, that paper became the spokesman for the spokes instrument for the Soviet government. And it was all through Soviet history, right? It probably still is today.
Isn't it defunct as of 1991, or is it back?
I don't know. I don't know what happened to Pravda. I'm sure it was probably, it might be defunct.
I found on Wikipedia, ceased publication, August 22nd, 1991.
Okay, so it died with the Yeltsin administration.
Would you like to read number 4, dispatch?
Dispatch number 4, Sir R. Paget to Mr. Balfour, September 10th, and that's the same date as the next New York Times article that you found. I have received a telegram from Petrograd as follows. Wholesale arrests and decapitations have resulted from an attempt on Lenin and the murder of Uritsky. Now, decapitations, let's talk about that for a second. Clifton Emmerheiser has a saying that when the Jews get control, the heads roll. And that's exactly what happened in the French Revolution, right? I mean, nobody was basically decapitated from Roman times for many years, for centuries in Europe that I've ever read until the French Revolution. Then the head started to roll.
Absolutely.
And now the Bolsheviks get power in Russia, and what happens? Decapitations. The Jews have some kind of sexual fantasy about headless people, I swear.
I'd also like to point out that Uritsky's full name was Moshe Solomonovich Uritsky.
Solomonovich, is that a Russian name? Somehow I don't think so.
And I posted a link to his picture in the chat so people can look at him and decide for themselves.
Yeah, well, I'll bet he's got a big hook nose.
You'd bet right.
And little beady eyes.
Again, you're right.
The okay, let me continue with the report. The Bolsheviks are arresting bourgeois men, women, and children having no connection with the authors of these attempts on the plea that they are faced with conspirators. According to official reports, more than 500 persons have been shot during the last 3 days without inquiry or sentence. Fresh executions are being prepared, and the press is full of bloodthirsty articles.
Well,
Lockhart was arrested and condemned to death, but at the last moment we succeeded in saving him. 28 British, including British consul and 11 French, have been arrested at Petrograd. In the prison's conditions defy description. In the fortress of Peter and Paul, where all the British are confined, prisoners have absolutely no food. In order to remedy this, we have now succeeded in forming an organization. Every night, executions take place without trial. Executions at night without trial. Doesn't that sound like the when they seize Christ? The Jews love the Satan loves the to operate in darkness, doesn't he? Terrorism continues. Protests against these proceedings have been made verbally and in writing by foreign representatives, including Germans. Lists of more than 1,000 hostages has been published by the government, by the Soviet government, amongst whom are 4 Serbian officers who will be shot if an attempt on the life of a commissary should be made.
And I'd like to just take the time to point out here that earlier there was a History Channel, basically a Judaized documentary presenting the Judaized version of events of the French Revolution, and they pointed out that Robespierre took a very anti-capital punishment stance prior to coming to power, and he played on the idea of basically liberating the peasants from the prospect of corporal punishment or capital punishment, yet as soon as he came to power, he started saying that tens of thousands of heads had to roll for the security of the state, or else the counter-revolutionaries would undermine everything they'd achieved. And then there was Jean-Paul Marat, who was agitating for upwards of 100,000 heads to roll. He said that the state wouldn't be secure until 100,000 heads had rolled. Aren't we seeing this again in Russia?
Well, yeah, and I'm surprised we're not seeing it here. With Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod and that black-looking Jew in the White House, I'm surprised we're not seeing it here. And I'm surprised there weren't guillotines on the White House lawn instead of menorahs this December. Maybe next year. I have just received news of the murder of Captain Cromey by the Bolsheviks and accusations of the later against him. This is September 6, 1918. Fact is that gallant officer devoted his whole time at Petrograd to the service of his country. His first object was to prevent the Baltic fleet from falling into German hands. Remember, we still have this war going on. And he then helped in evacuating valuable stores and laterally gave most of his attention to plans for preventing a German advance on Vologda. These activities, carried out for months in daily danger of his life, brought him more or less into the cooperation with Russians hostile to Bolshevik regime and theretofore claimed as reactionaries. His plans may well have included destruction of certain bridges, as Bolsheviks declare. In Captain Cromey, His Majesty has lost the most gallant, capable, and devoted servant. This word reactionary, you know, it's a good word. And it's been programmed into most people that it's a bad word. You know, if the Bolsheviks want a revolution, what does a conservative do but react to that? To react to preserve your nation, your culture, your religion, that's a good thing, right?
Yes, but I don't think we can manage if all we do is react to everything they do, since eventually they will push us back and we're on the defensive. We need to counter their revolution. We have to become counter-revolutionary.
Well, right. We should become proactive, but we never have and we never are. But the reactionary term is actually, you know, that's a defensive position is reactionary, and it's good to be a reactionary instead of just being someone that I hate to use the metaphor, but being someone that bends over and takes it. That's what the Jews want, a non-reactionary.
Yes.
The extermination of bourgeois and social revolutionaries preached. Now, this is another article, just like the prior one, that surprises me very much, coming from the New York Times, September 11th, 1918. And it says, Stockholm, September 10th, the latest Bolshevist papers to reach here are filled with sanguinary articles, appeals and resolutions demanding a mass terror against the bourgeois, or the middle class, in consequence of the attempts on Lenin and Yeritsky, which were committed by the socialists. So the middle class has to pay for something that the socialists did. That's basically what they're saying, that the Russian press, that the Soviet press. The general watchword is individual terrorism. The commune of the North has, or Petrograd, where we are with these embassy reports, has decided to begin the extermination of the bourgeois and its conscious agents. In other words, anybody that ever bought anything at a merchant store should die, I guess. Krasny's Gazeta publishes a dispatch from the front at Smolyev, demanding pitiless vengeance and death to the social revolutionaries. Laws and tribunals of justice are not necessary in order that their blood may flow, that they may be exterminated. That's the typical bloodthirsty Jew all through history, concludes the dispatch. The next day after the outrages, the Petrograd Soviet passed a resolution increasing the wages of the Soviet Guard to 500 rubles a month in addition to their food. It is especially characteristic that during the last few days, no section of the population, even the working class, has received any bread. Workers only receive small rations of meat. And it's as old as Roman times. When you want to control an army, keep giving them raises. That's what the Roman tyrants did. That's
and
what
in
the
fact,
Caesars.
They inflated their currency to worthlessness.
Right. Well, that's what happens, and that's what we're doing today. You know, getting these soldiers, getting these boys to fight in Iraq and getting them to re-up for 4 more years and giving them $50,000 and 4 years free college, and it just inflates the currency and inflates the currency. And it's a pyramid scheme, and eventually it all falls down.
In the end, they let the soldiers take loot from the bourgeois to the tune of basically gold watches, chains, and food. And we're seeing in Zimbabwe, Mugabe lets his soldiers go into whatever shops happen to have goods, and they can take whatever they want.
And quite often the Roman tyrants did the same thing. They did the same thing. They would be fighting these civil wars, or they would be fighting these wars of conquest, and they'd run out of money, so they would allow the soldiers to go loot, pillage, and rape, and collect booty in place of pay.
And basically,
when the Roman troops had moved into a country, that those people became Roman subjects. So basically, they're letting their soldiers rape, loot, and pillage their own subjects.
Absolutely. Should I jump ahead a bit and read one paragraph discussing how they actually pay the soldiers?
Go ahead.
It's from Dispatch 37, February 13, 1919, Status of the Red Army. No more satisfied are the soldiers. In fact, the only troops the Bolsheviks can trust are the Lettish, Chinese, and a few battalions of sailors. They give them 250 rubles a month, all found, together with presents of gold watches and chains requisitioned from the bourgeoisie. Newly conscripted troops are not given rifles in Petrograd, except a few in each regiment for the purpose of instruction. They are only handed out to them at the front. For any military offense, there is only one punishment, death. Executions are done mostly by the Chinese. If a regiment retreats against orders, machine guns are turned on them. And if the commissar of the regiment cannot thus hold his men, he is shot. All the soldiers I spoke to, even those acting as our guards at the prison, cursed their fate at being compelled to serve. The only alternative being death from hunger or execution as deserters. Nearly all openly expressed the hope that the British would soon come and put an end to it all.
And we see that the from that we see that the Bolsheviks brought Chinese troops in, didn't they?
Yes.
To enforce their will. And that was a common trick of the Romans also.
Using foreigners against their own people.
Well, right. Well, they would bring, they'd take the Greeks in Greece, they'd raise legions there and move them to Britain. And they'd take German legions and put them in Greece, and they'd put British legions in Germany. And they would always use foreigners against their subject peoples.
Today they call it... Oh, sorry, go on.
Because a foreigner is a lot more likely to do their will in a strange land.
They have no connection to the people or the land, and today we call it UN peacekeeping missions.
Exactly.
And it seems that the international Jew is once more getting ready to bring the Chinese in to do his dirty work, since if this country rises up, I've said before that world Jewry will bring down so much hatred upon us, they will make our country the focus of all the world's wrath, much as they did with Germany, and this time they will use China as their primary enforcer against our people.
Well, exactly, and that's why they've built up China. That's why they need the at least two superpower paradigm to maintain control. That's why the Rothschilds tried to split America in the war of northern aggression. And I can't, feelings are always mixed on that because the North did wrong against their brethren in the South. There's no doubt. However, it's the Rothschilds that wanted the country split in two because they couldn't, that they believed that they couldn't handle one powerful nation here, that they wanted two so they could pit one against the other. Just like they always pitted the French against the Germans and the French against the English and the Germans against the Russians. That's the way they like to do it. So they make sure they collect their debts and that they don't get thrown out of everywhere. And eventually they're going to be thrown out of everywhere.
All right. Shall we get into number six?
Report number six. This is an excellent report. It's a little lengthy, but it's
the most important, I think, of the entire document.
I wouldn't go that far, but yes, in some ways it is. Okay, Sir M. Finley to Mr. Balfour, September 18th, 1918. Following is a report by Netherlands minister at Petrograd, the 6th of September, received here today on the situation in Russia, in particular as affecting British subjects and British interests under the minister's protection. Sir, on 30th August, I had left for Moscow, largely in connection with negotiations for evacuation of British subjects from Russia. The same day, Yuritsky, commissary at Petrograd for combating counter-revolution, was assassinated by a Jewish student, Cain Geiser, whose father is a wealthy engineer and holds a very good position at Petrograd. So we see the Soviet, the Bolshevik was killed by a Jew. The Bolshevik commissar was killed by a Jew.
How fitting.
And the Jewish newspapers, that they wanted all the French and British destroyed for it, and all the bourgeois destroyed for it. And the committer of the crime was actually another Jew.
Certainly the British inspired him. They put him up to it.
Oh, I'm sure. This murder was at once attributed by the Bolshevik authorities and Bolshevik press. The Bolshevik press, the only existing press in Russia, he's saying, is the Bolshevik press. Bolshevik press attributed it to the French and English. That same night, Consul Woodhouse and Engineer Commander LePage were arrested at 1 a.m. in the street. Every effort was made the next day, 31st of August, by my secretary, M. Van Niftrick, to obtain their release, and that of Consul Woodhouse was promised for the afternoon. At 5 p.m. on the 31st of August, when Consul Bosanquet and Acting Vice Consuls Timmins, who had been busy the whole day with M. Van Niftrick in connection with his attempt to obtain release of the arrested, and were heading to the embassy and were near the embassy building, they were warned not to approach the embassy, told that it had been occupied by Red Guards, and that two persons had been killed. They at once decided to head back to find M. Van Niftrick and ask him to endeavor to secure entry into the embassy. While driving slowly away from the embassy, their car was stopped by Red Guards in another car, one of whom leveled a revolver at them and told them to hold up their hands. They were searched and had to give their names and rank, but to their great surprise were allowed to proceed. M. Van Niftrick drove with them to Gorakhovaya, headquarters of the Commission for Combating Counter-Revolution, to which persons arrested are usually taken, and where Mr. Woodhouse was confined. He had a long interview with the commandant of Petrograd, Shatov, and strongly protested against the unheard-of breach of international law which had taken place, and demanded to be allowed to drive immediately to the embassy to be present at the search there. Permission was refused by Shatov, who said that the embassy was being searched because authorities had documents proving conclusively that British government was implicated in Yuritsky's murder. When they had left and their car was passing the Winter Palace staff of the British consulate and of missions, and some civilians who were at the embassy when it was invaded were seen walking under guard to number 2 Gorakhovaya, and that's where they brought prisoners. So that means they were arresting everybody in the British embassy.
And that's a serious breach of international protocol and etiquette and obligation under international treaty, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. You know, and I grew up in New Jersey, and you know, we always read the New York newspapers, and you watch all the New York. You know, New Jersey had no newspapers and no TV stations. Everything was New York City. You felt like a part of New York City, and basically that's the way it is. And you know, because of the United Nations, and there's a lot of embassies and consulates in New York, and these diplomats would always be involved in hit and run car accidents and caught speeding and caught with drugs and doing this and doing that, and the papers would always say that, you know, they had to let them go, diplomatic immunity. You see that all the time in the New York papers because of the number of embassies there and consulates there. So yeah, it's basically unheard of. I mean, diplomats from foreign nations can basically get away with murder because they have that immunity. And that's well understood that they have that immunity. And even begrudgingly, when you know, they hate to respect that immunity, they still have to, basically. And a lot of diplomats do get away with crimes and a lot of petty crimes too, like speeding and drunk driving and hit and run accidents because of that diplomatic immunity. Okay, a meeting of the Neutral Diplomatic Corps was held that night upon the initiative of M. Van Niftrick, at which the following points were submitted. Now, these are the different diplomats from different countries getting together and having a meeting about what they're going to do in Petrograd with the Soviets treating them this way. That immediate release of those arrested should be demanded. That it should be insisted upon that M. Van Niftrick should be present at the examination of anybody arrested. That attention should be drawn to gross breach of international law committed by armed occupation of the embassy, which bore on the door a signed and sealed notice to the effect that it was under the protection of the Netherlands legation, and by refusal to allow M. Van Niftrick to be present at the search. Hmm. The meeting, in other words, even if they were going to search the embassy, the ambassadors and consulates should be present. The meeting drew up a protest to be presented to the Soviet authorities at Moscow. On the 1st September, particulars were learnt as to the violation of the embassy. The Red Guards, under the direction of several commissaries, had made their way into the embassy at 5 p.m. and behaved with the greatest brutality. Captain Cromie, who had tried to bar their entrance and had been threatened that he would be killed like a dog, quote-unquote, had fired, killing 2 men. He had then been shot himself and died nearly instantaneously. The whole staff of the consulate and missions and some civilians accidentally present at the embassy had then been marched under escort to Gorakhovaya number 2, or to prison, basically, where they remained until Tuesday, the 3rd of September, when at 4 p.m. they were conveyed to the fortress of Peter and Paul, another prison. During the next few days, repeated efforts were made by M. Van Niftrick, M. Van der Pals also, counsel and neutral legations to obtain release of those arrested, but without success. M. Van Niftrick endeavored successfully to obtain an interview with Zinoviev, president of the Northern Commune, on the 1st of September. M. de Scavenius, the Danish minister, who expressed profound indignation at what had occurred, saw Zinoviev at 9 p.m. on that day and expressed himself in strongest terms. He was promised that the body of Captain Cromie should be delivered up to him and M. Van Niftrick, and on the 2nd of September, they together removed the body to the English church. The funeral took place in the presence of the whole corps diplomatique, and the greater part of the British and French communities. The coffin was covered with the Union Jack and was completely wreathed with flowers. After it had been lowered into the grave, I pronounced the following short address in French and English. In the name of the British government and in the name of the family of Captain Cromie, I thank you all, especially the representatives of the Allied and neutral countries, for the honor you have shown Captain Cromie. Friends, we have all known Captain Cromie as a real friend, as a British gentleman, as a British officer, in the highest sense of the word. Happy is the country to produce his sons like Captain Cromie. Let his splendid and beautiful example lead us and inspire us all until the end of our days. Amen. So it seems to me that they were allowed, you know, the British church in Petrograd is still operating, and they were allowed to hold the Christian funeral for the man.
Absolutely.
Well, which is, you know, that at, you know, actually, it's outside of how we view the Bolsheviks as immediate destroyers of the church and everything Christian. That they were, maybe perhaps they were just preoccupied and lax and letting a Christian church operate in Petrograd for this long.
They were biding their time. They didn't want to tip their hand. I'm sure if they started hacking priests apart and raping nuns, particularly foreign ones, that would bring down a lot of heat on them.
Well, absolutely. It seems that, but they would still seem to be treating the foreign ambassadors and the foreign embassy staffs pretty cruelly.
Yeah.
I mean, to be I mean, this one ambassador knew that it was a Jewish student who had assassinated Yuritsky.
And I'm sure they knew that Zinoviev was actually Applebaum and he was a Jew.
Okay.
Should I go ahead and read the next? The next page?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
The doyen of the Corps Diplomatique, M. Odier, Swiss minister, gave expression to his deep sympathy and admiration for the late Captain Cromie, who had died for his country. Quote, "In the evening of the 3rd September, no impression having yet been made on the communal authorities, another meeting of the Corps Diplomatique was held. This meeting was attended by neutral diplomatic representatives and M. van der Pals, representing the Netherlands legation. Unexpected feature of the meeting was the appearance of German and Austrian consul generals. The whole of the body met together at 9 p.m. and proceeded to Zinoviev's residence, where they with difficulty succeeded in obtaining an interview with him. M. Odier strongly protested in the name of the neutral legations at actions taken by communal authorities against foreign subjects. He emphasized the fact that for acts of violence committed against foreign subjects in Russia, the Soviet officials would be held personally responsible. He demanded that permission should be granted for a neutral representative to be present at the examination of the accused. Zinoviev said that
And here he seems to be taking for granted that these people, these Bolsheviks, cared about international law and things like that.
Yes, or that they gave a darn about human rights.
Yeah, right.
Zinoviev said that he must consult his colleagues on the matter. M. van der Pals afterwards again laid stress on this point. M. Odier was followed by German Consul General, who made a forcible protest in the name of humanity against the terrorism now entered upon Bolsheviks. I'm sure that fell on deaf ears. He referred in strong terms to sanguinary speech of the other day by M. Zinoviev and said that even though French and English arrested belonged to nations at war with Germany, yet it was impossible not to unite with neutral representatives in a strong protest against course now adopted by Bolsheviks. Quote, I returned to Petrograd yesterday as I had received a telegram from my secretary urging my return and could not therefore take responsibility of remaining longer absent from Petrograd, where position I gathered must be very bad. Up to today, situation here has in no way improved. Besides British arrests, numerous arrests of French citizens have taken place, including that of the commercial attaché to French embassy. Though French consular officials have not so far been touched, thousands of Russians belonging to officer and wealthy classes, not excluding merchants and shopkeepers, are being arrested daily, and according to an official communication, 500 of them have already been shot. Amongst arrested, there are a large number of women. For the last 4 days, no further British arrests have been made. Quote,
now, let me just say that if you read the Communist Manifesto, there is an absolute hatred for what they call the bourgeois. But if you really want to, if you really read that their writing and their other, some of the other writings of Karl Marx and the Jewish communists at the time, contemporary Jewish communists, you'll find that when they say bourgeois, they mean the middle class productive backbone of the nation.
And that works out to about 75% of the country.
Well, right. And the Jews hate middle class white Christians, and that's what it boils down to. And they use code names and like bourgeois and vague terms in order to veil and you could see through a veil to some degree that their beliefs to mask over their beliefs so that the average person really doesn't know what they're talking about.
So the coal miner who makes $10,000 a year thinks, oh, they're referring to the pharmacist who makes $60,000 a year. And he thinks, oh, they're referring to that elite lawyer who makes $200,000 a year. So everyone always thinks, oh, I can be part of this great revolution. And it's always against the elite. And the elite is someone who's above me. Yet they don't realize that they're all part of the elite in the mind of the Jew.
Right. Absolutely. When the Christian hears the word bourgeois, he pictures the upper class nobility, the lawyers, the doctors, the people like that, the political movers and shakers. But when the Jew thinks of the word bourgeois, he means the everyday middle class white Christians too.
All right. For last 4 days, no further British arrests have been made. Quote, position of British subjects in prison is most precarious, and during last few days, constant reports have reached legation that question whether to shoot or release them has not yet been decided.
Well they're flipping coins, probably.
There seems to be also a strong tendency to regard those arrested as hostages. Those belonging to military and naval missions are probably in most danger, and in present rabid temper of Bolsheviks, anything is possible. But there is some hope that consular staff and civilians may be released before matters become still more serious. With regard to members of missions, hope of release seems very small. Quote, conditions under which Englishmen at Peter and Paul Fortress are kept are most miserable. I was informed yesterday by M. Darcy, commercial attaché to French embassy, just released, that they are crowded together with other prisoners, some 20 in a cell, 20 by 10 feet.
Now these are embassy personnel and consulate personnel.
Yes.
These are foreign diplomats.
In each cell, there is only one bed. Rest must sleep on a stone floor. No food whatever is supplied by prison authorities, and they depend entirely on arrangements which this legation has made and food furnished by friends and relatives. Rugs, pillows, medicines, warm clothing, and other comforts are being sent from time to time, but great difficulties are experienced in getting these articles delivered. From the 31st August to morning of the 2nd September, no food at all was accepted for prisoners. Since then, they have received some supplies from outside. but it still remains to be seen whether it will reach them regularly at Fortress, though. I shall leave no stone unturned to secure its proper distribution. Russian prisoners in Fortress appear to be absolutely starving, and this will make question of supply of British subjects even more difficult than it would otherwise be, owing to presence in their cells of famished Russians. I enclose herewith copy of letter just received from British prisoners, which speaks for itself. Quote, yesterday evening I endeavored to see Zinoviev in order to inform him of appalling conditions at the fortress, but he absolutely refused to see me. I was equally unable to see Yuritsky's successor and could only gain access to a subordinate of latter, who behaved with lack of courtesy, which may now be expected. I informed him of conditions obtaining in Fortress, and he eventually promised to speak to Commandant of Fortress, whom he had occasion to see that night. He refused to give me the number of Zinoviev's telephone or name of Commandant at Fortress. Quote, as regards situation in Moscow, I can only say that in my opinion it is most grave. 19 Englishmen and 30 Frenchmen have been arrested and are kept under the worst conditions. Mr. Lockhart, who was released and subsequently rearrested, was only saved from being shot on 4th September by my most strenuous exertions. Before I left Moscow, a solemn promise was given to me that he would be released, but his position is precarious in the extreme, while all those now under arrest there are in great danger. Mr. Lockhart is accused by Soviet government of organizing a plot to overthrow it, and Bolshevik official and unofficial papers are full of details of alleged conspiracy, while it is asserted that British officials at Petrograd were concerned in plot. Attempt on life of Lenin is, of course, attributed by Bolsheviks to British and French, and if he should die, it is quite possible that all now under arrest at Moscow and Petrograd would be shot. At Moscow, I had repeated interviews with Turchin and Karahan. Whole Soviet government has sunk to the level of a criminal organization. Bolsheviks realize that their game is up and have entered on a career of criminal madness.
Now, he, from his perspective, he thinks that this Bolshevik regime is still, that this Bolshevik takeover is still going to fail. And that's what he's saying right here. The Bolsheviks realize that their game is up. So they've resorted to a career of criminal madness. This revolt at this time, that this revolution is, that this is September 18th, so it's 11 months.
So they figure if it's going to fail, they might as well kill as many goyim as they can.
Well, right, that's this diplomat's attitude that he's attributing to them. That's what he's saying about them. And he's wrong that it's going to fail because, you know, obviously it didn't. It was successful. But he personally still believes it's going to fail.
I repeatedly told Chicherin, with all the energy of which I am capable, that he must realize full well that Bolshevik government was not a match for England. England had a longer wind than the Soviets. She would not be intimidated. Even if hundreds of British subjects should be executed by order of the Bolsheviks, England would not turn one hair's breadth from her purpose. Moment would come when the Soviet authorities, man by man, would have to pay for all the acts of terrorism of which they committed. But in spite of persistence with which I drove these facts home, I could not obtain any definite promise from Chicherin, but only a few evasive replies and some lies. Bolsheviks have burnt their boats and are now ready for any wickedness. As regards original objects of my journey to Moscow, evacuation of British from Russia, I found it necessary to promise that Litvinov should be allowed to leave England at once, provided that in exchange for this concession, all British subjects in Russia, including consular staffs and missions, were allowed to leave the country. And the reference to them burning their boats, that's a reference to what Hernando Cortez did when he arrived in the New World, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it has to be.
He burnt his boats, so his men had no hope except advance and conquer. And
right, there's no turning back.
He was a Sephardic crypto Jew, wasn't he?
I believe so. I believe that a lot of those conquistadors probably were, too.
All right. This was agreed to so far as consulates and civilians were concerned, including those now under arrest at Petrograd, but an exception was made with regards to members of military and naval missions who would be released only on arrival of Russian Red Cross delegates in France for the purpose of repatriation of Russian soldiers. Result of negotiation was reported by telegraph to His Majesty's Minister at Stockholm for communication to British government. As regards invasion of British embassy at Petrograd, I had occasion to present the Chicherin and Karajan in addition to my protest and demands for repatriation embodied in my note to Chicherin of 2nd September, joint protest drawn up by neutral diplomatic representatives to Petrograd, see above, which I also signed, demanding release of all those arrested at embassy and that embassy should be handed over to me, and stating that Soviet government would be held responsible in every respect for consequences of this breach of international law, which was quite unique in history. This I reported to my government at The Hague through the intermediary of Chicherin for transmission to British legation there, though I cannot affirm that telegram was sent. Chicherin wished to evade question of release of persons arrested at embassy and only agreed to demand for embassy to be handed over to me, but I told him plainly that it must be all or nothing and that I would not consent to half measures of this kind. I have further demanded that all documents seized at embassy shall be delivered to me. The foregoing report will indicate the extremely critical nature of the present situation. The danger is now so great that I feel it my duty to call the attention of the British government and all other governments to the fact that if an end is not put to Bolshevism in Russia at once, the civilization of the whole world will be threatened.
And this right here this paragraph is very prophetic on his part, and I hope that people listen to it. Go ahead.
This is not an exaggeration, but a sober matter of fact, and the most unusual action of German and Austrian consul generals before referred to in joining in protest of neutral legations appears to indicate that the danger is also being realized in German and Austrian quarters. I consider that the immediate suppression of Bolshevism is the greatest issue now before the world, not even excluding the war which is still raging. And unless, as above stated, Bolshevism is nipped in the bud immediately, it is bound to spread in one form or another over Europe and the whole world, as it is organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose one object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things. The only manner in which this danger could be averted would be collective action on the part of all powers.
So here we have a minor diplomat from the Netherlands who sees in September of 1918 that Bolshevism is going to be a threat to the entire world if it succeeds in Russia. And he makes it, he spells that out, and he says that it's organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose only object is to destroy for their own ends, the existing order of things.
Isn't that what they've always done?
He recognizes that Bolshevism, that Marxist communism, is a Jewish device against Christendom. He recognizes that fully here. And he says if this succeeds in Russia, we're all in trouble. And today, America is basically a Marxist nation.
I think it's important to point out, too, in the abridged edition that was released of this document, this paragraph, the one we just read, was removed, surprisingly.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all in the abridged version that this paragraph wasn't removed. It was probably the main object of abridging the whole thing.
Absolutely. I am also of opinion that no support whatever should be given to any other socialistic party in Russia, least of all to social revolutionaries, whose policy is at the moment to overthrow the Bolsheviks, but whose aims in reality are the same, vis-a-vis to establish proletariat rule through the world.
And he has to mean the Mensheviks, right? Mensheviks and the other Jewish socialist parties.
Yes.
And there were other Jewish socialist parties who were competing for primacy with the Bolsheviks.
They all wanted to be king of the hill.
Right.
Social revolutionaries will never fight any foreign power in any profession which they may now make in this sense are merely a tactical move in their struggle with the Bolsheviks. I would beg that this report may be telegraphed as soon as possible in cipher, in full, to the British Foreign Office in view of its importance.
And thank Yahweh that it made it out. But, I mean, it's nice to see it in hindsight. It's nice to see in hindsight that at least some people and were aware of what was going on. Even though the horse is long out of the barn, it's way too late to do anything about it. It's nice to see that that there were some people aware of it.
And then continuing on with number six, he just gets into a letter from the fortress of Peter and Paul. Should we stop on this note or continue on and finish up?
Yeah, we could stop on this note. We don't have to. It concentrates on the abuse of the prisoners and the starvation of the prisoners, and maybe we could just take highlights from that in the next program.
All right, so in this one, we showed that the Jews have been planning this revolution for decades, that the 1905 revolution was the direct result of their planning, and it failed because Russia hadn't been pushed that far down yet, although Russia essentially lost the Russo-Japanese War because they funded the Japanese so much, that is to say the Jews did, with their alliance between the various groups in Russia and, of course, all the Western banking houses, which were, of course, run by Jews.
Right, absolutely. And with all of Russia's best men on the front fighting the Germans, Russia was ripe for the taking.
Hmm.
And with the huge loss of life that it had suffered fighting the Germans.
Since Russia was no police state, they didn't have 10,000 police in every city ready to oppose the Bolsheviks.
Exactly. And from M. Raphael Johnson, we see that there were only 5,000 armed policemen in the country. Well, you know, when you have a homogenous country, a racially homogenous country, what do you need cops for? The crime rate in white nations, in all white nations, is usually negligible.
Well, land-wise, Russia is, what, approximately three times the size of the U.S.? Population-wise, at the time, Russia had half the population we have today, yet we have approximately 600,000 police in this country.
Right. We have 30,000 cops just in New York City. At least 30,000 cops just in New York City.
Mm.
In a population of 7 million or 8 million.
That's because a multiracial empire has to be held together at bayonet point.
Exactly. Right. And the blacks and Latinos that populate New York City, they live by the law of the jungle. That's basically how they live. They don't know any law but the law of the jungle. So to live under our laws, well, we need a tyranny to control them. And it's still off the hook.
For the sake of preserving this abominable multiracial empire, we've all lost all of our precious freedom.
Absolutely. There is no doubt. And a lot of it's the drug war, you know, which is phony, because it's the Jews and the CIA bringing most of the drugs into the country.
Yes.
It's clearly the Jews and the CIA. Right, just Google Israeli crime ring or Israeli drug ring, and they pop up all over the place.
Well, I was going to say that they basically go after the wildcatters who bring it in on their own, and that's what you see on TV when they say, oh, we busted someone that had 500 pounds of marijuana in the trunk of his car. You see that, but what you don't see are the CIA planes landing at military airports, and they're unloading it by the ton.
Absolutely. And they do. They go after the wildcatters, and they put on a good show for the public as we have a complete erosion of our constitutional liberties.
Hmm.
And they're the ones bringing the drugs in. There's
well,
no doubt.
I mean, if you think about it, the British Empire went to war at least twice explicitly for the opium merchants, the Iraqi Jews, the Sassoon family, so they could ship opium from Iraq and India into China and addict all of China to opium, and they basically destroyed the Chinese Empire that way. And right now we have American soldiers in Afghanistan guarding poppy fields, whereas in 2001 and 2002, it was projected that Afghanistan would export no opium. Since the Taliban began a crackdown in 2000, it was nearly completed by middle 2001, and UN data said that by 2002, if everything continued as planned, Afghanistan would produce zero opium. They would export none of it. And it wound up that the U.S. invaded halfway through 2001, and in 2002, 2003, Afghanistan produced more opium than ever before. In fact, they exceeded the previous record by a factor of three.
Well, right, and you know, it's absolutely incredible to me that the people, the average citizen does not see that all you have to do is watch the headlines, You know, when I was a kid growing up in the 70s, the big drug on the street was, hashish, but the biggest drug on the street was heroin. And that was because the CIA was operating in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia in Southeast Asia, where poppy grows, where there's a huge poppy industry. And when Vietnam ended and Nixon pulled out, the heroin basically disappeared. It sharply declined in availability.
Then they went to Nicaragua.
And then we went to Nicaragua and started messing around with Noriega and the Sandinistas and Daniel Ortega and all those turkeys. And what happened? Cocaine flooded the markets here, the black markets. And all through the 80s, through the Reagan administration, cocaine was a big drug. And basically now that's kind of trickled off, because we're back in Afghanistan, where poppy grows, and heroin is the big drug again. Why can't people see that pattern?
You're just a conspiracy theorist. You're drawing conclusions. It's just a coincidence.
It's absolutely incredible. People don't see that pattern. And there's the ecstasy and the LSD and all the drugs that come right from Tel Aviv, and there's no doubt.
Well, they've caught rabbinical students that are going to Talmud schools that fly back and forth on a weekly basis from Israel to the U.S. Traditionally, they would not search them, since they said it would be an insult to search a rabbinical student, since they're people.
Well, they're the first ones that should be searched, because wherever you see a rabbi, there's already been a crime.
In fact, one day, one of them was walking through customs, and his suitcase accidentally fell open, and he had 30,000 ecstasy pills inside, and he was immediately arrested.
Yeah, and they don't get much time for ecstasy. They really don't. They get all the. I saw a lot of guys in federal prison for ecstasy, and they all had 2 to 5 years. But meth and crack, and you're getting your head beat down, because crack is a poor nigger's drug, and methamphetamine is a poor white man's drug, and they're made here. Not the crack, but the methamphetamine is, that they're made from chemicals. I mean, they make it harder and harder to get those chemicals. And believe me, I do not one bit condone the use of drugs, in that sense, of chemical drugs. However, the government, I think, goes real hard on meth, because that can be made in your backyard, and they do not like the competition.
Absolutely. And I wanted to point out about the graph, the data on the poppy production. I got it from the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. I typed in about poppy production, and I found the graph in 2 minutes. So it's there. Americans can't say, we don't have access to the information. We don't know. I found it in 2 minutes.
Right. And it's incredible that people don't see the pattern, that the prevalent street drug always seems to be coming from where the CIA's operating. That's a real simple pattern to observe just from the last 30, 40 years of our history.
And I also pointed out on a website, too, to some people, when they said that we're in Afghanistan because Bin Laden and 9/11, I posted an entire copy of the FBI Most Wanted profile on Bin Laden. It lists him in connection with embassy bombings in Africa. It does not list anything about 9/11. And I pointed out that some people have called them and asked them, and the response is typically along the lines of, we have no credible evidence that he was ever involved in 9/11. That's why it's not listed.
That's funny.
So if the FBI says they have no credible evidence that Bin Laden was connected to 9/11, why are we in Afghanistan? Opium.
Well, absolutely. It's not because the Taliban shot up some Buddhist statues. They really don't care about Buddhist statues.
Or it's not because they make the women wear those burqas.
No, we should be making our women wear burqas. That might save Western civilization. Or at least a few of our women from the Negro rapists. I guarantee you every nigger in prison right now is thinking about a white woman. That's the way they are. And McBragg mentioned them, earlier about how they're all itching to get out and what's going to happen when the government has to let them go. But every nigger in prison is dreaming about getting his hands, his greasy paws on a white woman.
All right. So next week we will pick up and we will get more into the basically the terrorist activities of the Bolshevik regime, how they abused prisoners, how they held their army together through sheer terror and the taking of hostages.
Yeah, the wanton murders and all the things, all the crimes of the Jews in the Soviet in the Soviet Union, yes.
Maybe we'll get into what the Bolshevik concept of free love entailed.
Oh, yes, that's important because that started with the Bolsheviks. They invented it.
Well, not necessarily the ones named Bolsheviks, but Jews elsewhere invented it.
Absolutely. Well, they're all Bolsheviks. I mean,
absolutely.
They're not only Bolsheviks because they're in Russia in 1918, believe me.
Every Jew is a communist, whether he admits it or not.
Okay, I'll see you next week. Praise Yahweh.
Yahweh bless.